Hour number two of Ethics. Here in the year 2017, how do we live ethically amongst our fellow men without offending? That is the issue that we're going to address today as we look at the cultural difference argument. And as we continue with this strain of adventure as we go forward, we're going to do it so in the spirit of wonder. We want to discover what makes our life a meaningful existence in this world. This is your internet pastor. I'm no longer I am an ordained minister. I no longer minister in a church. That is not where I am. I am living amongst the people in peace and trying to bring about an ideology that speaks of peace. Now, the first things that we have to recognize is that at the heart of cultural relativism is a certain form of argument, and we may call this the cultural difference argument. There is a difference. That's why you find, and I was listening to hour number one, and it was a little bit too didactic for me. So what I thought that I'd do today is I'd make it just a little bit more practical for you. Okay. And the best way to do that would be to remind you about the election and what happened. You know, the red and blue states, the you don't agree with this and I agree with that and you're right and I'm wrong and all that kind of stuff. So we're gonna look at that cultural difference argument, and I'm just adjusting everything here in the studio. Give me a minute. I'm right in the middle of a project here personally in my home to get some work done because of some things that I have to get done in my life. And I hope that you guys are doing good out there. Let's talk about this a little bit. There are three consequences to cultural relativism. Three consequences. And you might say, why are these things important, John? I don't understand. Because, well, if you don't understand these things, when you run into these type of predicaments, you're not going to know what to do. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to give you some tools. And like I said a little bit earlier, I'm going to keep this on the simple. On the simple level, I'm right in front of the mic. So what I want to do is stay right up. This is much better. This is good. You can no longer say that the customs of other societies are morally inferior to your own. We as Americans need to learn that. Don't think that because we're the richest country in the world and we have more sustenance or substance and the things that we have, that our culture is necessarily better than another person's culture. Nor should we any longer criticize the code of our own society. That makes sense. Why would you criticize the way things are being done? You know, I live in a world where everybody's saying that Trump is a racist. I'm not going to follow Trump. Trump is bad. Trump is... you know what you ought to do? You ought to think about your own lives. And thirdly, the idea of moral progress is called into doubt if we do things like that. And you don't want that to happen. Now the consequences of taking moral relativism seriously are spoken about by one philosopher, William Graham Sommer, and he says that the notion of right is in the folk ways. Now, I'm going to use the Germans in World War II as an example of that. The notion of right is in the folk ways. Do you know who the leader of the Third Reich was? That was Adolf Hitler. All right, he came to power in the 30s. In Nazi Germany, he became their chancellor, Chancellor Hitler. And you might say, how could he send his army in over the borders of Poland? How could he lock up Warsaw and turn it into, you know, its capital, one of its major cities, into a ghetto and start exterminating the Jews? Because the notion of right is in the folk ways. It is not outside of them. This had to take place within the mindset of the German people itself, not just Adolf, but everyone there if they were to survive. And the same kind of nonsense can happen in this country. That's why we have checks and balances in this country. That's why we have a Democratic as well as a Republican Party. All right? So the notion of right is in the folkways. It is not outside of them. It is not independent origin that is brought to test them. This comes to them. In other words, whatever is right for them is right for them. If this is right, what are the consequences of this? Well, we can no longer say that the customs of other societies are morally inferior to our own. We would be barred from the criticism of analyzing the other culture. We would live as isolationists. I can barely say the word. We would live in isolation. Now, if you want to do some historical research about that, it was Woodrow Wilson that formed that idea way back in the area of World War I. It was during a time when America was engaging in World War I, and the majority of the population of American people would say that they did not want to get involved in a global war. They didn't want to send their sons overseas to die for other people. President Wilson then put together or constructed in his mind with a group of other elites the League of Nations that existed before we have our current United Nations. I believe that both were utterly a failure because it failed to bring about what needed to be brought about. And so we have to figure out, what do we have in common? What our culture has in common with another culture? In other words, what would a society be like if there were no code of moral conduct? Let's say that someone murdered somebody. How do we contend with that? How do we deal with the culture that deals with murder? Most cultures kill people that kill people, you see. And so the conclusion is that there are some moral rules that every society must have in common. Because what? These rules are necessary in order for that society to exist. So when you judge the cultural practice to be undesirable, well, that's some practices that just goes against common sense and humanity altogether. Now, when the famous philosopher Aristotle was asked about ethics and what it meant, he came up with this idea that we get this claim, Nicomenean ethics. What is Nicomenean ethics? When Aristotle was asked about the good, which was the aim of every action, and about what could constitute a final good, something that was to be sought for its own sake rather than for the sake of something higher. See, we take ethics now to a higher level. We have to do that because we can't leave it on the ground level. He came to the view that the highest good for man was eudaimonia, which literally means having a good spirit. Or perhaps it can be translated as happiness. Aristotle said, every human being is seeking for eudaimonia, happiness. That's why we take our children to amusement parks. I recall a young man came to visit me, and he brought his son along with his baby mama. And what he did is he put on the television screen some Mickey Mouse cartoons. The child's not old enough to understand what's going on, but I noticed the child in the crib was looking at the big screen and smiling and waving his arms. That was eudaimonia. That was happiness. Aristotle saw this as a state in which a person was fulfilling his or her own potential and natural function. Well, I think that there's a little bit too much eudaimonia in America, too much happiness. Now, Aristotle continued with this idea, and it expressed a form of human excellence or virtue, okay? in the Greek, it was looked upon that way. This tied into the general view that everything has a final cause, a good of a purpose for which it moves. Is this why we buy the new Audis? Is this why we fancy ourselves in wearing clothes that some supermodel, a superstar like Beyonce would wear? This brings a lot of women, and some men, unfortunately, eudaimonia. If you understand the final cause of something, you also understand the fundamental essence which finds its expression in that goal. And this is what is happening in the transgendered community around us, because they cannot finally express themselves. You know, I speak with gay men a lot. And I say, you're a man. Why are you seeking to be a woman? I don't understand this. It seems that some people find a happier essence in being different from what they are. And I believe that what each of us are, we are used to the extent of our purpose. If a knife had a soul, Aristotle argued, that soul would be cutting. That is what it takes to be a knife. That is what the knife is there to do. It's there to cut. Aristotle would say that the happiest goal is eudaimonia. Find out who you are, what you are. I recall recently a friend of mine went on the internet telling everyone that he's down and out because he has nowhere to stay. Well, I know about that because often I try to help people in that dilemma and help them out a few days, and so that they can find a little comfort in their hearts, as opposed to being decimated or devastated by homelessness. This is a big problem here in Los Angeles. But ethically and philosophically, as I look at it, now I'm trying to weigh or to judge me by the results of this questioning. Okay, why is the person homeless? How am I to feel about this person? Is there something that I can possibly do to alleviate this problem? You see what I mean? Thinking about it ethically. Aristotle would say that it is the rational choice of one's actions. He thought that this eudaimonia should have a social as well as an individual aspect of it. And this is the way that philosophers think today. Now, in Rachel's book, The Elements of Moral Philosophy, it's the question of homosexuality comes up. Gay writers have said that it is not about who you have sex with. It is about who you are in love with. You see, philosophically, the person had to highlight what is going on here. Do you think that that's a decent statement? And if so, why is the statement decent? Is the question of homosexuality all about sex or love? And then you'd have to ask the same question about heterosexuality. What is that about? You see, and it's not what you feel, because if you feel that homosexuality should be considered as acceptable as an alternative lifestyle, then why or why not? What attitude should we take about this? We might say that homosexuality is immoral, or we might say that it is acceptable, not depending upon what you are, but as you look at the life itself and analyze it, as you weigh it. Now, our weighing processes also can sabotage us, because there is a certain type of objectivism as well as subjectivism in ethics. The basic idea of ethical subjectivism is that our moral opinions are based only upon our feelings and nothing more. If you want to weigh yourself in an ethical code, can you weigh it subjectively? Yes, I can. Why? Because I feel this way. But let's talk about a little bit how that theory came about, or what they call the evolution of the theory. It goes through three stages. People find certain ideas attractive. So they're going to agree with those ideas. If you ethically believe that something is right or something is not right, it is because you come to that in your mind. Hopefully, if you listen to lecture number one, you can see how we weigh certain situations and come to that. Others retain confidence in the basic idea, refining it to a new, improved formulation. Well, it all depends upon the way that I personally view homosexuality. But let's look at the simple stage of subjectivism. Okay, let's say that we won't call it homosexuality. Whatever the issue may be, we'll call it X. Okay? X is acceptable. X is right. X is good. X ought to be done. All that means that I approve of X. See, that's simple subjectivism. Let's say Chevrolets are morally acceptable. To own a Chevrolet is right. To own a Chevrolet is good. I ought to own a Chevrolet. So, I approve of owning Chevrolets. You see the way you work that out? That's just simple subjectivism. And then that's how we come to making that right. Or you can say X is morally unacceptable, meaning that driving a Chevy is insane, it's wrong, it's bad, I ought not drive a Chevy. All that means that I disagree with Chevrolets. You see what I mean? That's simple subjectivism, and that is the way most people do life. Well, they say homosexuality is morally unacceptable, it is wrong, it is bad, it ought not to be done, I disapprove of homosexuals. That is the way people make judgments. But is it based upon anything that is objectively true? Or is it subjectively false? That's the idea that we have to deal with from time to time. Now, there are objections to this ethical subjectivism. Simple subjectivism implies that we're always right. That is the way people come to a foundation. Well, I'm always right. My wife used to argue with me a lot, and she used to say, John, do you think that you're right in everything? Of course I'm not right in everything, but that I'm sure of, I'm going to push that. I must admit that since I have outlived, I think, my particular age, and I see a lot of people, here's a white-haired man walking down the street, walking his dog, and I see more and more of that. Did you know that there are more Anglos? Listen to this. I live in a part of Los Angeles that they call South Central. But every time a house comes up empty, there are more white people, Anglo-Saxon Americans. They're not African American or Hispanic American. They're moving back into this neighborhood. The shift is taking place. Man, with them building this Charger Stadium and these other things, one of my new neighbors is a white fella, and he works out of the home, and he has his business associates coming by. I don't know what he's doing, but with these computers, you can work right out of your home. I'll probably be doing that because my days of getting in that car and driving to the college are probably over. But simple subjectivism implies that we're always right. Is simple subjectivism a flawed form? I think it is, because it contradicts that plain fact that none of us are infallible. None of us are infallible. You can't say that you're right because you want to be right. Now, what is emotivism? Emotivism, and this is the second stage, okay? Emotivism begins with the language that observes that it is used in different ways. Let me give you an example. Lance Armstrong beat cancer and then won the Tour de France 7 times. Now, you have to look at that. That's emotive language. Lance Armstrong did not beat anything. You see, you have to know that. He didn't beat anything. He could not beat anything. Here's another one. Gas prices are rising. You know, gas prices can't do anything. Now, there's a difference between emotivism and simple subjectivism. Remember, simple subjectivism should now be obvious. It interprets ethical sentences as statements of fact. All homosexuals are going to hell. That is not a statement of fact. It is not. Because a homosexual can love God and know God's word and abide by God's word. They just don't listen to other people telling them how to live their lives. I don't think that anyone lives like that. Anyone does. I recall one time I went to my pastor's house for a teacher's meeting, and we had a little time to chat before the other guys got there. And I told him that I was going to Dorsey High to, you know, run a few times around the field around 4:30 in the morning. And at that time, it was yet dark. And he tried to tell me what I should or should not do. As a young man, I corrected him and said, "You may teach me theology. You may correct me when it comes to knowing something about God in my understanding, but you don't dictate to me what I have freedom to do in my own life." And I asked him, did he understand that? Because I'm not going to follow any man telling me anything like that. I've never been a puppet on a string, especially in the church. I've always known that. So emotivism emphasizes that there is more than one way which people may disagree. And so I'm letting him have his say. But when is simple subjectivism correct? Well, because sometimes it is, you know. Well, it's correct when we're always right in our moral judgments. You see what I'm talking about? Simple subjectivism works if you're always right in your moral judgments. Simple subjectivism always interprets moral judgments. Now, there could be something wrong with that statement, okay? Are there any moral facts? Because Stevenson, he's another philosopher, and he comes up with ethics and language, and he says, what moral facts do we have that we can build upon? He says there ought to be a connection between moral judgments and the reasons to support them. Where does it connect? Where do you connect those things? The emotivist might say, well, a moral judgment is like a command. It is primarily a verbal means of trying to influence people's attitudes and conduct. That is what the preacher does. And since the preacher does that, well, there we have it. Stevenson continues, any statement about any fact which any speaker considers likely to alter attitudes may be adduced as a reason for or against an ethical judgment. And we all need to know that. We need to know that. Now, you may be saying by this time, you know, PJ, I thought that ethics was going to be something better than that. I'm just looking for the right answers. I'm looking for the right thing to do, and you're not helping me out with this. You're confusing me with all of these dictums, with all of these dispositions and attitudes. Well, I just want to share something with you, my young friend, and I want you to concentrate with me if you can. I'm giving you moral facts in the same way that there are facts about planets and trees and spoons. Certain spoons are used for certain things, certain fruits come from different trees, and different planets do different things. Our values are nothing more than the expressions of our subjective feelings. Now, what ethics does is it brings you down to the core of it. You have an opinion that you push. You believe in that, and you push that. You push that on your children. They push it on their children. This is the way a society gains its acceptance or denial of some other idea. This is what Socrates was confronted with. He was confronted with these things as he tried to teach the young men in his society about what is right, what is the correct standard, what is the correct thing to do. He was teaching the young people about those things, and in doing so, it got him into a lot of trouble because the elders of that society some 2,000 years ago, Miletus in question was the attorney that accused Socrates of all of this wrongdoing. Miletus came against him with the other bourgeoisie individuals and basically forced Socrates to commit suicide. But Socrates would not recant and do what the civilization wanted him to do. I'm kind of like that old-fashioned guy. You know, I can't live amongst a society that will not allow me to be myself. It's very important. Our values are nothing more than the expressions of our subjective feelings. Moral truths and truths about reason, that is, a moral judgment that is true if it is backed up by better reasons than the alternatives given. That's how we make our decision or make our minds up. And then I'm asking you to focus upon reasons. Okay, the answers as to why. A truth in ethics is backed up by reason. Reason alone. The correct answer to a moral question is simply the answer that has the weight of reason on its side. There's no reason for black people to fear the police. Listen to me. There's no reason. If you think that a white police officer, two of them stop you, wants to choke you out and kill you, you are living in a horror story in real time. That doesn't make any sense. Listen, you cannot make something good or something bad by simply wishing it to be so. You know, I wish that all the straight people would disappear. See, I blew your mind because you thought that I was going to say to gay people. That shows you that you've been contaminated or polluted by someone else's thought. That's why I'm giving you these ethical lessons. You're not to reason like that. You cannot make something good or bad simply by wishing it to be so, because we cannot will that the weight of reason be on its side or against it. You can't do that. Now, someone may say, John, is there any proof in ethics? If you have Rachel's text, that's under 3.6. It says, when a proof is demanded, people often have in mind an inappropriate standard. But in ethics, rational thinking consists of good reasons, analyzing arguments, setting out to justifying certain particular principles. I love the way this is turning out, because what it's forcing me to do, it is forcing me to look at this and say, why do people in my society make judgments on other people? They usually make judgments on other people because they have the weight of the other person's opinion behind them, but they have nothing factual to back it up with. Here recently I was shamed, literally shamed, as I saw a black man that did, 20 years in prison for raping somebody that he never raped. That another person comes out and admits that they did it. They pass a lie detector test and they go into this guy's life, take him out of jail, and they ask him what were the major changes that he noticed in the society since he went away. He said, technology. He said, the way things work. Man, it's like me taking a driver's license test for the first time last year since 1960, 1963 or four. That's when I took the first driving test. I didn't have to go and take it again until last year to renew my license. And I failed it two times. And the third time, I passed it. All right, so let's jump to the next thing in ethics. What is happiness? What is happiness? A hit of the marijuana cigarette or the pipe? What is happiness? Euphoria? What is happiness? Human sexual orgasms? If one is really happy, is that person's life going pretty good or well? And if you say that, well, yeah, my life is well, what is well? And is that the standard of true happiness for everybody? Is your standard of happiness the standard of happiness that everyone would choose? One has said that true happiness causes pleasure. And this pleasure is where we get our English term from the human term, hedonism. And so what is happiness? Is your happiness hedonism? A life of happiness would be a life that contained a balance, a favorable balance between pleasure and pain. Now, so are you really happy? If it is a balance between pleasure and pain, do we all experience that? That's very important. Very important. I'll take a break. Skipping on through here, we're moving very, very good pace, a very fast pace. Jump on down into chapter 4 right now, morality and religion. And religion is very important to a lot of people that adopt to the Christian view of doing things. You know, well, I'm a moral person because I go to church. I'm a moral person because my pastor tells me that I am. Is that necessarily so? I'm a moral person because God deems me to be a moral person. So would this be a theory that fails or fares in America today? Because that's a question that I want to ask about it. Can we define morality by religion? And when you look at the religious leaders and the institutions that foster such ideas such as that, it causes one to think out loud. Would the majority of our society today wholeheartedly agree with Russell's analysis of religion, and why are his thoughts so important to us in our society today? Why is it important to connect morality with religion? And can one necessarily do that? That is a question that we have to ask. And so what he does in chapter 4 is he immediately takes us into a theory. And this particular theory is called the Divine Command Theory. Now, for those of you that have never heard this theory before, I want you to pay very close attention to it because of the way the theory is used. It can be used for you or against you. And so you have to be smart enough to realize or to understand in particular exactly what I'm talking about. Being morally right by the Divine Command Theory. Being morally right is a matter of being commanded by God, or being morally wrong is a matter of being forbidden by God. That's the Divine Command Theory. This theory is that, well, you can't do that because God says you shouldn't do it. It's a divine command. See? And so now what you have to do is you have to look at that command wherever it is, do the proper exegesis of that command, and you do a linguistical use. Who was the writer? Who was the writer writing to? Why did he write it? What did he expect out of his readers? Because they had to read it. They didn't have audio sound waves back then. Was that written for our culture? Was it aimed at us? See, that's how you figure out the Divine Command Theory. And the reason that you have to do that, because you have to ask a very important question. What would an atheist say to this? Would an atheist necessarily agree with you? This theory, this conception of morality, is mysterious because we can't define God. We don't know whether he actually is or whether he actually said it. We have to believe in the cleric that preached it. I recall for years when I was a preacher and I preached things like that, I used to always ask people, did they understand fully that these are not my words? And that number two, I could really care less whether a person kept that command. Second thing that you have to say is this conception makes God's commands arbitrary. Right, because it would be based upon something that took place, which would put God in a position of changing in order to stop you. Because God is not a controlling taskmaster, as some people might think. As a matter of fact, some people think that I am, but I'm not that. I'm not that. This conception of morality provides the wrong reasons for moral principles. The wrong reasons. All right, let me give you a good example. You got a teenage boy, he's 13, 14 years old, and he's masturbating. And then you come with a divine command theory that, you know, God says that if you're a teenager and you touch yourself, that you're going to go to hell. Now, see, now that makes the conception of God arbitrary. Did God say that it is wrong for a person to masturbate? I don't think so. See, that came from someone else. You have to do your moral principles like that. Now, Hamlet put it this way. Well, that is, in the writings of Hamlet, Shakespeare, the author, whoever he was, put it this way. Nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Now, this is something to think about. That this is the conception. Listen, that's why the mysterious conception of the divine command theory put you in that area. But Shakespeare said it isn't good or bad, but thinking about it makes it good or bad. And so this conception of morality that we're talking about, what's wrong with it? You have to ask questions about that. What's wrong with the person's statement based upon the statements that he makes? You have to be able to answer that question. And if you can't answer it, well, then you'll never be able to. You're going to find yourself in jeopardy. See, is it reasonable to think of God in this way? If you're going to use the divine command theory, I'm going to raise the Bible and I'm going to throw it in your face. I try to tell people that I know what the Bible says. I know what is taught. As a matter of fact, I was working in my library yesterday out in the main office, and I got rid of a lot of stuff that I no longer use or need. And some of them are books. I had to clear some spaces off there. I won't read them again. And there's nothing to me holding on to something. Is it reasonable to believe that today I would try to do as I did 20 years ago? No. How do we resolve the author's fallacy then? That's the question that we have to answer. And when you're doing ethics, it forces you to do that. Does the author conclude in any way that satisfies your view of moral ethics? Do you believe in the divine command theory and what it proposes? And after reading his conclusions concerning the divine command theory, are we convinced that their concept is correct or incorrect? You have to come to that on your own. I can't help you with it. I've come to it for me, and this is what I do. Can I tell you? I don't listen to any man. And the reason that I don't listen to any man when it comes to the divine command theory, the divine command can only come from God. And so when a man tells you that something is amiss with you, I would, peradventure, propose that you go to God personally to seek an answer from him. Now, when these people try to make themselves the divine command theory, what they try to do is they try to tell you, well, I'm God's representative, so you're to listen to me. You don't want to be taken in by stuff like that. You need to ask them, how do I know that you're God's representative? And why don't you give me the text from which you're quoting from? And, well, there is no text for that. There is no text saying that a 13 and a 14-year-old ought not masturbate. Well, who are you to say that they ought not? Well, it can be harmful to your health. I want to share something with you. It's a book I was sharing with a young man not too many hours ago. Let me roll over here and get the book. Roman, you know I'm doing a webcast. I'll talk to you when I can. I've spoken about this text. I've spoken about this text before, a number of years ago. And up in the top corner says Sexual Secrets Every Man Should Know. The book is called The Multi-Orgasmic Male, and it is by Mantak Chai and Douglas Abrams. And what they do is they speak to men about that part of our nature that has been made taboo. And I find it amazing that this part of our nature has been made taboo, and in certain cultures, from people around the world, it is very naturalistic for this nature to be exercised. It is for the formulation of family, of course, and of course the formulation of pleasure between the couple. But I am surprised that of all of the religious groups, that certain religious groups put a voodoo hole on this situation. I would ask you to look up that book, The Multi-Orgasmic Male, by Mantak Chai, that's C-H-I-A, Chaya, and Douglas Abrams. It is a book that can really help moderate and train a young man on human sexuality in a way that I've never read the book. I understand that some of the soldiers in our country that were sent to the Arab nations overseas were given this particular text to read, because of course you can't have relations with people of other cultures like that. And so those boys over their 13, 14 month deployment periods, this shows them how to satisfy that libido. It's very healthy. It's very normal to do that. And if you check with any medical physician, they would agree with what I'm about to tell you. The lack of sexual action on the behalf of a healthy male works against your health. It's just as simple as that. And so quiet is kept. You want to see someone that is intelligently taught about themselves. And if this is offensive to some of you church people out there, and you don't even think that you should touch it when you urinate, well, go ahead on with your bad self. I'm not mad at you. Did you know that the theory of natural law comes after the divine command theory? Because the people that are not religious would say, well, I don't believe in God, so I don't believe that any command divinely comes from God. Now, that's important. That's important to know. And listen to what I'm telling you, see, because this natural law theory was a dominant theory of ethics in the history of Christian thought. And it rests on the view that the world is like this. It's natural to see a man with a woman. It is unnatural to see a man with a man. It is unnatural to see a boy masturbate. It is natural for them not to do that. Well, and they think that everybody's view of the world is just like theirs. Therefore, the world has a rational order, and it has value and purpose built into its very nature. So this is the way the natural law comes about, right on the heels of the divine command theory. We're talking about ethics. What is right to do, and how do we do that? Aristotle, about 350 years before Christ, asserted these questions. He says, in order to understand anything, four questions had to be asked about it. And the first question is, what is it? Now, you have to listen to me very close, because what I want you to do, see, you know, we're talking about the identifying prospects here. What is it? Do you know what it is? The second question is, what is it made of? Because if you know what it is, you've got to know what comprises its elements. That's what it's asking. And then the third question is, how did it come to exist? If you don't ask these particular questions about things, you are not interested in the origin of ideas, or necessarily the origin of a thing. And the fourth question is, what is it for? In other words, what is its purpose? I like that. I love asking those questions, because in asking those questions, it deems me to be an intelligent fellow. I was telling some young men around here today in my house. I'm in my house. I don't like to be closed up. I don't like to be doors shut, people talking to me. What you doing in my house? What you talking about in my house? Why are you talking? Why aren't you working? Why aren't you investigating? See what I mean? I'm asking the question, what is it? What is it made of? How did it come to exist? And what is it for? Intelligent people that have ethics and logic ask those kinds of questions of your generations all the time. I don't know why your generation is so touchy about prying and investigation. That's the only way that you can know what a thing is. So Aristotle, 350 years before Jesus was born in Nazareth, asked these questions. I'm not asking these questions for the first time. For some of you that are listening to me, you are hearing them for the first time in your life because you haven't asked enough questions in your life. That is why when I say, you don't know what I'm talking about, do you? And you can't answer me, it's because you don't know what it is, what it's made of, how did it come to exist, and what is it for? And let me put this little asterisk on this point right here. If you're a dude and you don't know that, Jesus, what are you following it for? You know, that would be like a drug that you're putting in you. You ask a question, what is it? Okay, well, it's just, what is it made for? Was it prescribed to you? How did it come to exist? Did it come from a pharmacist, or did a drug dealer put it together and said, what is it for? In other words, what you doing it for? You see what I mean? You ask those four questions, you never go sour. You never will. You never will. These are absolute questions in logic and natural law. These kind of questions natural men ask of everything. And if a man and or a woman do not ask those questions, they are bound to be deceived. More on Aristotle's natural law. He had had thoughts about natural objects. He said that even the objects that we do not make have a purpose. And he's right about that. I didn't make my dog Bro Man, but I guess Bro Man has a purpose. Bro Man makes me happy. Bro Man makes me smile. Bro Man gives me a reason to be happy. Not exactly. Bro Man has one purpose in this life, and that's to eat. That's all Bro Man does. He's constantly mooching. You see? See, so Aristotle's thoughts were not limited to organic beings. They were limited to the metaphysical aesthetic situation in the heavenlies. He asked those kinds of questions. According to him, everything has a purpose. Now, what you have to do ethically is you have to answer the question, can you rightly say that everything that you know of and are made of has a purpose? See, that is a question that I would pose to you. To give an illustration of natural law, one would have to look at the duty of beneficence. Okay? Beneficence. Natural law has been used to support moral views that are contentious. In other words, you know, we're taught to be beneficent. You know, the Christian church ascribes to this law. And outside of the Catholic church, the theory of natural law has few advocates today. See? And so, you know, we're told to do things like that because that's the things that we ought to do. And that's why we do it. But we don't ask the four questions as to why we do it. Now, David Hume was another philosopher, and he does not affirm natural law. No, he does not. The theory is rejected. It is widely rejected because the view of the world conflicts with modern science. So Hume would say, I don't necessarily agree with that. So you're not going to find every philosopher agreeing with every philosophical ethical theory, just like you're not going to, you know, you're going to find a difference in the way Republicans think and the difference the way the Democrats think. A great difference between the way an independent person thinks as opposed to someone that is dependent upon someone else's purpose. Because modern science gives a picture of the world as facts, whereas only natural law, there's only the laws of physics, chemistry, biology, and it's all working to bring about a particular purpose. So I think that I've said enough in this cast. I'm going to stop right now until we get into part three. And once we get into part three, we're going to move into areas of, let's see. Yeah, we're going to continue with religion. Then we're going to go into Jewish and Christian early problems, problems with the New Testament and ethics. And then we're going to continue to go down as we look at the debate. And I hope that you're enjoying my lectures on ethics. You know, just take the points that I've given you, try to stack them up in the best way that you possibly can, and know that if you employ these tactics in your life, it should get better for you. Thank you for joining me for lecture number two. Be sure to keep abreast for lecture number three.